Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. Yaakov Katz here with Lahav Harkov. And this week, Lahav, obviously there's a ton of news that's happening out there in the world, in Israel, obviously Russia and Ukraine. And you had so much you wanted to say that you actually sat down and created a list of topics that you said we have to make sure we talk about. So I'm going to hand this over to you, the microphone to you, because I think you got a lot you want to say.
Yes, I have an outline prepared. And first of all, it's because we had a conversation on the phone earlier that got me thinking. And in that conversation, you and I kind of traded places compared to last week when I was very critical of Israel, not doing enough for you, like that Israel was being very neutral on Ukraine. And you were talking more about the need to be considerate of Syria. And I don't think we traded places per se, but you were sort of saying, and you can talk about your position more, that, you know, at this point, we just need to be all in for Ukraine. And I agree that Israel needs to do a lot more for Ukraine, frankly. Like, there are many things we could do and we're not doing. Just to give the example, the ambassador of Ukraine to Israel said that they need protective gear. They need helmets. They need vests. Apparently, the entire supply of helmets in Europe is exhausted, according to the ambassador. And, you know, those are the kinds of things that I feel like Israel can donate without it being, like, too crazy with Russia, right? Like, I mean,
right.
Protective gear, I think we have plenty of. And, you know, we can't be responsible for the whole Ukrainian army, but for us to not give any is, you know, I just think we could be doing a lot more. And then also, not just on the, like, actual contributions, but also just the way we're speaking about it is really, I mean, the government is doing everything not to say the word Russia. At one point, Lapid said the Russian invasion is, you know, that we condemn the Russian invasion, and we also voted to condemn it in the UN. But Bennett, like, it's as if he forgot the word Russia. He doesn't say it at all, and he doesn't really say Ukraine either. He says we have solidarity with the Ukrainian people. We support the Ukrainian people.
Lahav, you know what was the best was when Prime Minister Bennett spoke with President of Russia Vladimir Putin. And in the statement that the Prime Minister's office put out said they discussed the situation in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And it was like, seriously, the situation? There's a freaking invasion of Ukraine by Russia. There's a war going on. People are getting killed. And you're the Prime Minister of Israel and you're talking about a situation. I think you're right. I think last week, As the war was just starting, there seemed, yes, I had two points. One was that Israel does need to look after its own interests. That's always going to be true. And number two is that there's really no reason for Israel to get involved. And, you know, there was talk again this week about mediation and Bennett offering that to Zelensky and to Putin.
No, Zelensky asked Bennett. And then Bennett spoke Zelensky with Putin. Zelensky has been asking Israel for a year to do this. And so Bibi asked Putin twice and Putin said no. Bennett asked Putin in October. Putin said no. Then Bennett asked Putin again on Sunday, which is 2 days after he talked to Zelensky. And this time Putin said, right now we want to do negotiations in Belarus, which we all know is like fake negotiations, but whatever. And he said, maybe I'll get back to you. So this time it was less of a no, but this is what Zelensky is asking Israel for. In addition to weapons and other things, Zelensky wants Israel to.
Right. But so on the mediation thing, I think that, you know, it's not our war. And where do you draw why push ourselves into it? On the other hand, where does that end? I mean, should we go try to mediate between China and Taiwan? Should we mediate between South Korea and North Korea? Should we start trying? I mean, I don't know why Israel would want to get itself mixed up in a battle between Russia, NATO, Ukraine, of course, but the U.S., Biden. I don't see how any good comes out of it. And I think we have to be Tsnuim, we have to be humble and a little humility of what we can do. And there might be something appealing and playing in the big leagues, but, you know, slow down there. That was that. But I will say is that, your trading places comment, I just, it bothers me. Like when I saw that tweet, it really annoyed me. And then when I notice how careful Bennett is in not saying Russia and not condemning, it's not a question of interests anymore. No, it's a question of values. And if we don't stand for something, then what do we stand for? Right. And of course we have interests. We have interests in Syria. We need to retain our operational freedom. I get that. I completely understand that. But we also have to stand for something. And it can't just be about interests.
Right.
And you know what? Maybe I'll just add one other thing. Maybe that's this government also. I don't know. Maybe this government is just, it's just, right, this government has no ideological theme or common denominator or anything that connects it. It's just about interest, getting rid of Bibi and creating a government, right? So they did that and interests keep them going. So maybe they're just the interest government. Maybe that's what we should call them. And they don't care about anything that has symbolism or ideology or principles or morals. But there are morals here. And right now we're standing on the wrong side of this. And that's a problem.
Well, no. So that's where I think it's going. You and a lot of other people from, you know, Joe Scarborough to Christiane Amanpour and all these other people are maybe going a little too far. Although maybe you're not going as far as those other people.
Ah, okay. Thank you. I was worried for a second. I'm part of the bad guys there. But okay.
No, but I think like we are on the right side, right? We condemned Russia more than once, but we are trying in some ways to like have our cake and eat it too. Like we condemn Russia, but like also we don't really want to talk about it that much. And I think like we don't have to be, you know, the United States or Germany, but we could add more clarity to our position, which I think is lacking. But I don't think that we're neutral or on Russia's side. And I also, talking to diplomatic sources from the EU and from the United States, they don't think Israel's neutral either. So that's good. But I think like on a public diplomacy level, on our public image level, we are not doing enough to convey the message that we're not neutral.
The fact, Lahav, that Christiane Amanpour on CNN in an interview with Bill Cohen, who was the Secretary of Defense back in the Clinton era, asks him, what do you think about Israel? Right. And why is Israel not voting with the U.S. at the Security Council, whatever it is, or signing on to that resolution, whatever it might have been. And for William Cohn to come out and say, you know, we've always stood for Israel and we've always supported Israel and I expect Israel to support. Like there's a narrative that's taking hold right now that is going to cause Israel damage.
Yes, Israel damage. And I agree.
And this isn't rocket science, right? There's a bad guy and there's a good guy here.
Any narrative in the hands of Christiane Amanpour is not going to be good for Israel. But I have to tell you, though, I think you're right. I think at this point, Israel has completely lost the narrative and has to consider speaking with more clarity, as I said. I also think, though, that there is a bizarrely disproportionate focus on Israel. Like, this isn't about Israel. Israel's not in Europe. Like, why of all the countries in the world are they fixated on Israel? Why don't they talk about the Jordan being neutral? Jordan hasn't been talking about it. They're a U.S. ally.
But we know the answer.
No Jews, no news.
Lahav, we know the answer. There's an obsession about Israel. There are people who want to cast a negative light on Israel. There are people who want to actively undermine Israel's relationship with the United States. And that's probably what's behind some of this. But with that said, we have to stand for something. And it can't just be interests. And I'll say something that maybe I shouldn't. So maybe I shouldn't. I don't know. But there's a feeling that I have that we're in that shtetl Jewish mentality right now. The state of Israel. You know, we go to the Russian Tsar or the Soviet Tsar, or whoever it was, and, you know, try to be good with him and find favor in his eyes. And at the same time, be good with the other leader of the world, the Americans in this case. Sometimes you got to pick a side. And we have to break out of the shtetl Jewish mentality. We are the independent, democratic Jewish state of Israel with a powerful military, diplomatic and technology and economic means. We don't have to be afraid of every little thing that we're going to say and do. And we have to stand for something. And I think Bennett's making a big mistake right now.
I agree with you.
So we can stop here. Okay, there we go.
No, but as the real military expert, I mean, what should we be worried about in Syria with Russia? Because Russia controls the airspace of Syria and we want to attack Iranian targets. We don't want Iran to become too entrenched. So I don't know, game it out. Like what could happen now?
I've heard the analysis by people that if we upset the Russians, they'll shut the airspace. They won't let us fly there. I mean, we're of course going to have a big problem. Okay. I completely get that. Right. But on the other hand, We also have to stand up and say what we believe. And if there's going to be a price to pay, then sometimes there is a price to pay. And we have to be prepared for that. But we can't straddle this line all the time that's just, you know, trying to keep both sides together, and it's not going to work. It's going to fall apart, and Israel's going to pay a price at the end of it, whether it's in the public diplomacy or something else.
I also kind of feel like who are we fooling, right? If there's going to be a new Cold War, whether Israel wants it or not, Israel should want it. But let's say Israel's trying to be neutral. We're going to be put on the American side. The same thing happened to us 70 years ago, by the way, when Israel tried to be neutral. And then it became, you know, then the Soviets started murdering Jewish doctors, and we were like, oh, maybe they're not such good guys.
Right. But also, Lahav, what does it mean, be put on the American side?
I mean, the world sees us, right? America's the great Satan and we're the little Satan, right? Like, everyone knows America's our ally.
But we should also want to be on the American side, because we...
100%. 100%. We should want to be.
We are a liberal democracy. We're against these totalitarian regimes. We're against dictators. We're against countries that just invade other countries and flagrantly and deliberately kill civilians. We're against all of that, right?
But I also feel like, right, like, and but the Russians know that. That's what's so crazy to me is, like, when it gets to this point, when there's such heavy sanctions, when so much of the world is against the Russians, like, all we're doing is letting them enjoy watching us squirm. But, like, frankly, like, we're on America's side. So it's like, we're not fooling anyone with this, like, you know, being quiet about it thing.
I don't know about you, but I'm sure that you talk to a lot of government people much more than I do.
Yeah.
Everyone who I've spoken to this week is so careful. It's like you're on the phone with someone, a minister, Knesset member, or somebody else. And you start talking about Russia, like, suddenly, like, they lower their voice on the phone. You know, have you noticed that? It's like the automatic, they just, like, start hushing or whispering. You're like, dude, we're just on the phone together. It's just you and I. Like,
yeah.
Nothing. If they're listening to our phone call, they're going to hear you whispering, or they're, you know, the same. But people, like, start to get really nervous about this.
Well, because Putin is a madman. I mean, if there's anything that we've learned, is that Putin is even worse than anyone imagined, right? Like, he's acting in a way that hard to understand, like, rationally what he wants here at this point. And so I guess there, in that way, there is a rational fear that, like, Syria could go really badly for us. But and that's not, you know, taking away from the fact that I still think that Israel needs to speak a little more loudly.
By the way, I mean, you know, Syria could go bad for us. But let's also remember, there was a Syria once upon a time with Scud missiles and chemical weapons, and they were building a nuclear reactor, and they had more tanks than us and more ground forces than we did. And we still managed to protect ourselves and defend ourselves and ensure our security interests. Now there's a Syria that's very weak. There's a Russia that's there.
And Iran.
And Iran. And we want to try to prevent Iran from entrenching itself. And we want to try to take out a convoy here and an arms cache there and a depot, weapons depot somewhere else. That's great. And that's important. But I mean, I don't know that if a few months we're not able to operate in the same freedom that we can now, hopefully we will still be able to operate, that's going to be this tremendous disaster for the state of Israel. I mean, come on. So, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
So I wanted to talk about another thing. If we were talking a little bit about, yes, like, how the world is looking at us, there was this report that came out, which I have not been able to verify, and I have my doubts about it, that Ukraine had asked for an Iron Dome and Israel said no. Now, I don't have my doubts that Israel, right, would have said no last summer if it was asked for the Iron Dome, but the ambassadors said, and this makes a lot of sense to me, that Ukraine doesn't really need the Iron Dome. The, like, very, you know, the rockets that Hamas uses, which don't have, like, you know, aren't able to aim at specific targets, are very different from the Russian missiles, and that's not at all what Ukraine needs. But meanwhile, you know, this lie has gotten around the world, and people are using it to accuse Israel of not being supportive enough of Ukraine. And it's interesting, like, what the Iron Dome has become, this, like, brand name. This is what everyone knows about missile security, and they think it's all powerful, and they don't realize that it's not actually relevant, and that Russia could probably destroy it in a minute.
Do you know what I also find to be slightly amusing?
Yeah.
Just on the Iron Dome thing is, you know, people say Ukraine wants the Iron Dome, right? Now, if you look at Kiev alone, Kiev is a city with about 3 million people.
Right.
Right. Ukraine is a country with about 44 million people. right? Something like that. Okay, we're a country with 9 million people. How many batteries do people think that Israel has?
Right, we have, I believe, 10, and the United States has 2.
Something like that. Maybe we've increased lately somewhere between 10 and 20, let's say, right?
Yeah, and also during wars, they're constantly moving the Iron Domes around to where they think things are going to hit, because we don't have enough.
Exactly. I mean, so you don't have enough to cover even a city of Jerusalem, which is only 1 million people.
Right.
Right, so... To cover obviously other cities and other strategic installations. So even the thought of like Ukraine wants an Iron Dome, like what you think we're just sending one battery over? I mean, like they would need to really protect Kiev, to protect their military bases, to protect their electrical installations, their strategic facilities, whatever they might be, and all their big cities, right? With 44 million people, you need a ton of Iron Dome. I mean, so even that idea is strange. But I mean, it's not surprising, though, that if there was some request that Israel would have said no, because Israel doesn't want to get on the bad side. We saw that, by the way, in 2008, if you remember, when Russia invaded Georgia. Georgia at the time was using Israeli drones mm-hmm. in a very effective way, made by Elbit, which is an Israeli defense company. And the Russians, after the war, came to Israel and were very upset that Israel had been selling them the Georgians' drones. The Russians wanted to buy our drones. In the end, there was a whole story behind that of where Israel agreed ultimately to sell them old, like 4 generation ago drones. But we also started to rethink the way we sell weapons to Georgia. So we're not going to get involved with an adversary of Russia by selling them weapons. That's not something that Israel would do. So, and I don't think anyone can expect us to do that. But there's a difference between that, Lahav, mm-hmm. and saying the right thing, right? That's the distinction that you're making, which is right. You know, one thing is selling weapons. The other thing is standing up for what's right.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to bring this to Iran every week. I know I'm like the...
Of course. It always has to be brought back to Iran.
And I feel like every single week I'm like, the Iran deal is almost finished. And that's because that's what everybody in the negotiations are saying. And I have to like restrain myself from using like non-family language about how I feel about these negotiations right now, because like it's been like 3 months that they've been saying that, you know, time is running out.
You know, I don't think I've definitely never used the term non-family language.
Whatever. But,
I don't know if I'm tempted to ask, what is non-family language?
Curse words.
I know. I figured that out. Yes,
right. So. No, but the thing is, I mean, I hope, but I think that it's asking too much, is that if Europe has sort of woken up and realized that it needs to stand up for itself and that there are actually bad actors in this world who want to start wars, it's not like some sort of paranoid delusion by Israel. So if they've understand it about Russia, that maybe they'll understand it about Iran and decide to actually be tough and, you know, finish these negotiations already. Like, how many weeks are they going to say, if Iran doesn't, you know, compromise, we're going to leave, and then they never leave? So that's where I am with Iran. And Iran is an ally of Russia. Like, why do they want to empower an ally of Russia?
Also, but like, what is the lesson ultimately? If you're the Iran, what lesson are you getting from what's happening right now in Ukraine? Right, and I think the way I see it is that no one can stop me. Right, what's the world going to do? They're going to talk and talk and talk, and they're going to sanction and sanction and sanction. But ultimately, they're not going to use force. Right. They're not going to go to war. They're not going to impose a no-fly zone.
Right.
They're not going to do anything that could risk a conflict. The West is not they're not there. And I think that therefore, if I was Iran to an extent, I'd also say I hear what people are saying, but also I wonder why the Iranians, why not kick it back a little, put up your feet and just wait, because there's no rush now. Right. The world has been shown that there's not much it can do. And that's sad, by the way. That's what's ultimately scary about this whole Ukraine conflict.
Yeah. And Iran has been able to deal not very well. Like, they are having big economic problems, but they seem to be surviving under sanctions for 3 years now. And so they're not scared.
Because they don't care about their people. And I think
Right.
Yeah. And they don't care about their people, just like Putin doesn't care about his people. I think that's, you know, when you don't care about your people. And you don't have, by the way, you don't have to worry about getting reelected.
Yeah.
Putin's not worried about that either. In a democratic country, that's one of the concerns always of a politician. You go too far, the people will pay back at the polls or the ballot box whenever that might happen. And there's checks and balances in government, right? The Knesset could bring you down here, the Congress, et cetera, whatever it might be. Putin doesn't have to worry about that. Ali Khamenei and the rest of them don't have to worry about that in Iran. So accountability is different. I don't know. I hear that and I say to myself, I would be very surprised if it happens, but maybe it will happen in the next couple of days. It'd be interesting to see. And then Israel will be, you know, again, you wrote a great piece in the beginning of the week. When the conflict began, or was it the end of last week?
Last week.
Time is a blur. That basically, bottom line, it was early. I think it was like the first or second day of the war. You wrote, basically, Israel can only rely on itself. That's the bottom line. It's so true. And it's true when you see what's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And how, and the Ukrainians, by the way, can only rely on themselves. It's also true to them. They can only rely on themselves.
Yeah.
They could get some weapons, some more Javelin anti-tank missiles. But that's it.
That reminds me of something else that's been annoying me about the talk about this conflict and Israel. So the Ukrainians seem to, or at least President Zelensky, but my understanding is that it's broader than that. The Ukrainians sort of identify with Israel, that they view themselves as, you know, like they have this enemy who is, you know, killing their civilians and thinks they don't have a right to exist. And so they like view themselves as Israelis. But if you were to read like comment, you know, all different analysts and people online, they feel like, oh, the Ukrainians are the Palestinians. Which I personally think that the conflicts are so different, you can't even compare one and the other. But I think that if you hear this kind of conversation happening with the activists, then they're going to try to take anything that's being done to Russia right now and have it be applied to Israel. You can count down the days until they're going to start trying to cut Israel off from SWIFT. I don't think it'll happen. I think it's very extreme. But I imagine that that's like where this conversation of comparing the Ukrainians to the Palestinians is going to go.
The fact, Lahav, that we at the Jerusalem Post had to write an editorial on Wednesday that basically said the Palestinians are not the Ukrainians, right? And because of people like Mehdi Hassan,
yes,
the MSNBC reporter, and others who have been referring to Israel's so-called occupation of the Palestinian people and what Russia is doing to Ukraine. I mean, the fact that we had to go and explain how this is so different, right? From, I don't recall anyone firing a missile at Ukraine firing missiles at Russia, that Russia felt the need to invade. I mean, there's just so many different reasons why this is so incomparable. But that just goes to show how people manipulate and corrupt and distort facts.
Yep. On that positive note.
On that positive note, yes. We have a jam-packed episode today with Zvika Klein, our reporter, Jewish world analyst, who's on the border with Poland and Ukraine, reporting from there on the Jewish refugee crisis and general the crisis that's taking place on the border, and meeting with especially the Jews, many of them who are now moving and immigrating to Israel, making Aliyah because of what's happening there. And he's telling of increased interest, by the way, not just in Ukraine, but also in Russia, of more requests to now immigrate and make Aliyah to Israel. And then we have another guest. Why don't you tell us about him?
Vladislav Davidson. He is a freelance journalist, a fellow at the Atlantic Council, and the author of a book, From Odessa with Love. He has been reporting out of Ukraine for a long time, and is a very colorful figure on social media. Just a really interesting person to follow.
And on the podcast.
And it was, yes, a good talk. And exactly, which is why I thought to invite him, because he has a very interesting sort of perspective and great way of describing the situation. So listen to that. It'll be very interesting.
So this is the Jerusalem Post podcast, full on Ukraine and Russia's invasion. Here we go.
This week, we have straight from Ukraine, Vladislav Davidson, a fellow at the Atlantic Council and the author of From Odessa with Love, who has been reporting from Ukraine for years. Vladislav, can you tell us a little bit about where you are? What's going on right now?
I'm really grateful to be with you. Love the publication. Thank you so much for having me on and for being interested in my work. I am in Chernowitz. I took a 10-hour taxi ride from the northwest border of Ukraine and Belarus, where I was reporting. I was in a town where I was in a good location, I thought, to be both behind Ukrainian lines and able to strike out and go see things, and not close to any Ukrainian military bases which could get bombed. I'm in a very precarious situation because I'm a dual Russian national and a member of two organizations, without naming them, which are on the Russian government's unfriendly list. So I'm a member and a fellow of two organizations which are, according to Russian law, unfriendly organizations or unlikable organizations. And I'm a Russian citizen, so I'm not going to be treated the same way as my Western colleagues are if I get picked up by a Russian patrol and taken to a filtration system. I may even be on those kill lists. I don't want to check.
Wow.
So what's the mood of where you are in Chernowitz, which is near Moldova? What's happening there? What's happening on the streets? What's with the people? Have you seen Russian forces
it's
there?
It's snowing now. It began snowing. There were air alarms. This town began getting air alarms the day before yesterday. Before that, it was totally peaceful. It's just a city with a very anxious situation like everywhere else. It's not seen any violence and it has not been bombed yet. So this city is not yet at the cusp of war, but they started getting air alarms yesterday, and the people I'm staying with, because every hotel room in this region is taken, were very upset about having to spend the night in the basement. So they just ignored the air alarms and we watched the news instead.
Yeah, we know what that's like from Israel too.
Yeah. No doubt.
So you had written, I read an article you wrote for the New York Post, and you had written about sort of being stopped on the street by Ukrainians and sort of how suspicious they are of foreigners. Could you just tell us a little bit about your experience and what it's like walking around there?
This is very typically Jewish. I'm not an Israeli citizen, but in the most Jewish way possible. I have four citizenships, but not of the country I was born in, which is Uzbekistan, not the country I call home, which is France, and not my historical homeland of Israel or Mordva. I mean, I'm an eighth quarter Finnish. I'm a Finnish Jew, a Viking Jew. So in the most typically cosmopolitan way possible, I have four passports, but not where I was born from, where I live, or one of my ethnicity, which is probably the most Jewish thing ever, right?
Right, yeah, wow.
So but in this situation, the only thing that matters is that I'm a Russian citizen, a member of the Atlantic Council and certain opposition groups. So I just don't want to be behind Russian lines. I'm not terrified or even afraid of being bombed or snipers or anything like that. I just don't want to get picked up and have my papers checked.
I'm curious, why are you not concerned about that? I mean, one of the things that we've seen is indiscriminate attacks by the Russians against civilian infrastructure. We've seen bombings in Kharkiv and places in Kiev and other cities around the country where they're just firing grab rockets and other weapons at civilian buildings. I mean, it's a definite possibility. Right.
It is a definite possibility. Look, I'm not gonna be in Kharkiv, which is under attack to the level of they should be creating a case against Putin and his generals at The Hague. But I was a refugee as a kid. I moved around a lot. I've been to a lot of war zones. I had training of the kinds that most civilians have not had. I'm at the point where I'm either a completely psychotic idiot or have a deep sense of being blessed by the Lord. I just don't think anything will ever happen to me, which is allows me to take all sorts of risks that normal people don't take. Probably I shouldn't push it.
Yeah.
Don't test it too much.
Right. How odd of God to choose the Jews, but don't go too far, right?
Exactly. You had recently tweeted an article that you wrote a few years ago about Volodymyr Zelensky sort of being this comedian who rose to power, and you were a little bit like skeptical about him at the time. And now it seems like he really has risen to the occasion. And I just want to know.
He is the greatest hero of the Western world at this moment. You're absolutely right. He is, in his star turn, in the moment of his career, In the moment when he had to act the part of Churchill, of the man who would not flee, come of the moment, come of the man, he has risen to the occasion. He is a 50-meter tall giant. He is an 8,000-ton political heavyweight. His approval rating in this country, according to internal approval ratings, seems to be 92%. I absolutely believe it. Any Ukrainian citizen who has watched the way he has behaved impeccably, without a false note, is proud of him. I do believe that the Ukrainian army and the Ukrainian state has held, partly because of a completely selfless little Jewish comedian who has played the part of Churchill in this very difficult moment. Who would have fought? Who would have fought? It's utterly amazing. I'm going to be writing an article as soon as I get off this Zelensky hero of the day, hero of our time. I think other people have written that article already. I'm just utterly impressed. Whatever it is that is inside of him, wherever these reserves of strength come from, I'm not into hero worship, but he is, in the words of my friend, the Portuguese public intellectual on Twitter, he is behaving in a way that I would like to know that I could behave. He is the future of Western civilization in terms of manliness or masculinity or whatever bravery, whatever it is that is the secret sauce of our civilization. He has.
Where does it come from? It's a surprise, right? You wouldn't have anticipated that this is how he would respond.
No one would have anticipated this. No one. I said this to British TV and a British journalist last night. We elected a combination of Benny Hill and Boris Johnson, and we got Churchill. History has thrown the. It is utterly amazing. This little Jewish comedian actor turns out to be acting the part of a lifetime, which is a war leader. And it's utterly flawless. Is it an act or is this really him? It doesn't matter. He stepped out of the TV into real life. He's a real boy now, made of flesh and blood. And he's a man also. And I do believe that the Ukrainian army and the Ukrainian people have not collapsed, partly because they have the example of a president who did not flee and did not surrender.
So that's important, Vladislav. Obviously, symbols and role models and examples. But I think there's very little doubt when you look at the Russian military versus the Ukrainian military that the Russians far outnumber, are more superior, technologically advanced, have more weapons. Everyone's now following this 60-kilometer long convoy of armored vehicles that's making its way to Kiev. And the question is, as a journalist, as someone on the ground, what's the sense? Is the sense really among the average Ukrainian, we can beat the Russians? We can actually win this war?
Okay, for the first 48 hours, there was this crippling sense of the Ukrainian political project is over. I was on the phone with someone who I talk with a lot. I shouldn't say this, but actually I will say this. I was on the phone with Poroshenko's former chief of staff, Mr. Loshkin, who is now the duly elected head of Ukrainian Jewish community, and a really, really strong man. And I asked him, what do you think the odds are of the Ukrainian political project surviving? This was in a terrible 36 hours. You think it'll survive? And he says, I very hope so, very much hope so. And I said, probably less of a chance of Ukrainian political project surviving than not. And he says, I don't know, but maybe that's right. Maybe that's right. Well, I don't know. We had this very pessimistic conversation, but everyone was having pessimistic conversations at that time. It didn't look like that the Ukrainians could survive this. Not only are they surviving, they've put up such stiff resistance that the Russians have not taken anything except Berdyansk. They've not, in four or five days of fighting, yet accomplished a single legitimate military objective. What have they done so far except kill a bunch of civilians and destroy people's homes and send 500,000 people fleeing or a million people fleeing into neighboring countries? What have they done except lose 6,000 troops, 800 vehicles, 200 tanks, 29 planes, 30 attack helicopters, a Buk system? What is it that they have accomplished? Nothing so far. Now, they are totally capable of pummeling this country into the dust from the air. They have almost total air superiority. And Russian military doctrine is about total suppressing fire from the air and from artillery before they send in the mechanized infantry and the infantry and the tanks. They ignored their own military doctrine because you can't do to Ukrainians what you can do in Syria to Arabs.
Right.
Because the population just won't stand for it at a certain point. Because, you know, a lot of us are intermarried. A lot of us are named Vladislav, and a lot of us Ukrainians have Russian last names, and Russians have Ukrainian last names. We are intermarried. There are historical connections between the Ukrainian and the Russian people. Clearly, there are things you can do you cannot do here, which even the Russian people would say this is too much, and it's clearly destabilizing the Russian economy now. But they are totally capable of blowing up this country from the air if they want to do that. Worst case scenario, they will pulverize Kharkiv, they will pulverize Kyiv, they will pulverize my native Odessa, and it's a shanda. It's a shanda.
How do you feel about the world's response to this? Or at least the Western world's response?
The world has stepped up. They need to keep sending weapons. They need to keep sending, most importantly, fighters. They need to create anti-aircraft capacity for the Ukrainians and to help keep the Ukrainian Air Force from being totally destroyed. They should allow the Ukrainian Air Force to use bomb-proof airstrips in Poland. I don't know if they are yet. Mm-hmm. Probably they are, because there are still Ukrainian air fighters in the air. This is top secret information. Probably no one's going to tell me this is true, but there are Ukrainian planes still operating in the air, which means they're flying around from somewhere in NATO air territory, I would surmise, although I don't know for a fact. The fact that the Russians have not destroyed every single aircraft in the air now means they're flying from somewhere where the Russians cannot reach them, to me. And that's great. If it's true, I would suspect it is true. Put my money on that. And the Ukrainians need to be given more weapons.
Vladislav, what are the conversations that we're having here in Israel has been about Israel's response to this? And you know, you follow Israeli politics, and I'm sure you've paid attention to the different messages that have been coming out of Israel, the Israeli offer of mediation, the failure or the refusal in the beginning to condemn Russia. And then yesterday, we're talking about on Monday, Yair Lapid, the foreign minister, said that Israel would condemn the Russians. How do you view what Israel's doing or Israel's play in this whole thing?
Look, Israel has a million post-Soviet citizens. Probably 60, 70% of them are Ukrainian Jews. 30% of them are Russian Jews, not counting people from Belarus and Kazakhstan, other places. Russia has troops on the Israeli border. The Russians are a neighbor of the Israeli army.
In Syria, right.
Yeah, in Syria, yeah. On the Golan. Russian mm-hmm. army's on the Golan. Russian army has, in moments, done all sorts of things, like allowed Hezbollah guys to wear Russian uniforms, which I think isn't very cool, you know? That's to keep the Israeli Air Force from bombing Hezbollah operatives. They were given Russian uniforms a couple of years ago. You know, Russia plays a very complex game, and it always has in the Middle East. Russia is now a power player in the Middle East. We all know this. If I was Israeli foreign minister or prime minister, and that's probably not going to happen of all the many possibilities in my life, that's probably the last of them. I would also play a complex game and kind of try to pivot between these two very useful relationships and good relationships. Jerusalem is one of the few places where the Ukrainians were willing to have these negotiations, including Turkey and Baku. It's an important security partner. It's the only country in the world which has a Jewish head of state and head of government, you know?
Yeah.
That said, there's a lot of people here who are pissed off at the Israelis not helping a Jewish president of Ukraine with Iron Dome missiles. I do think that the Iron Dome thing is overblown, because Iron Dome was not going to solve this problem for the Ukrainians. Iron Dome is not geared towards blowing up advanced Russian rockets, and neither do the Ukrainians have the kind of money needed to operate the Iron Dome? Probably operating it would eat up more than their entire GDP.
Israel doesn't even have the money to operate the Iron Dome. We have to ask America for it. So, yeah,
right.
But that's definitely a good point.
I mean, and I don't think the Iron Dome is geared towards the kind of super advanced rockets and Iskanders and Grads that the Russians are and the Katyushas that they would be firing. It's just not the kind of precision scalpel thing that you could use to undermine those rockets. But it is symbolic for a lot of Ukrainians who are like, wait a minute, why aren't the Israelis helping us? We're also a new nation, a startup nation. We're also fighting our historical enemies. We are also friends with the Jews, and we're also people who have their entire history been under someone else's boot. Why don't the Jews who live amongst us help us symbolically? And I understand I understand those arguments, even though there's nothing really to be said about that.
Well, you're saying the Jews who live amongst us, you think that there's some sort of like blame or scapegoating happening to Jews in Ukraine?
Not at all. The defense minister is a Jew, as is the head of a presidential administration and the president and half his team. Shafir's Jewish. There are, I mean, a third of his close comrades in the presidential administration, people he came up with in the entertainment world and show business are Jews. And the fact that Jews are at the forefront of this administration.
Do people talk about that, though? Do people talk about the Jewish role? The average Ukrainian, does he or she discuss that? Is that an issue?
No, in fact, I'm staying with just random Ukrainians. I was just spending last night having a conversation, not a drunken conversation, because there's no alcohol, sadly, in this country. Alcohol sales have been forbidden. We've had a dry, we've had 5 days of dry Ukraine. I haven't had a drop of alcohol in 5 days. Since the war started, there's no alcohol to be had in the country. Sales are forbidden. So I had a completely alcohol-free conversation with my new Ukrainian friends, who are just the relatives of an American friend here, who are putting me up because there are no hotels in this region because of refugees and the IDPs. We were just talking until 3:30 in the morning last night, and I was like, you know, the head of presidential administration is a Jew, as is Shafir, as is the Reznikov, the defense minister. And they're like, oh, we never really thought about it. We don't care who's Jewish or not. I said, yeah, Reznikov's a defense minister, not because he's a Jew, but because he's really competent at what he does, you know? Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah. And it's this refutation of the old kind of Ukrainian nationalism, the Petlura kind of peasant Ukrainian nationalism that allows half the presidential administration to have Russian blood or Jewish patrimony. And it's a good thing, and it's an indicator of what it is they're fighting for.
And it's the exact opposite of what Putin claims that they're doing, which is denazification.
Well, when he says denazification, he means cleansing. He says, we're going to cleanse Ukraine. He can't actually say cleanse because he sounds like a fascist. So he says, we're going to uproot the fascists. So it's someone using anti-fascist rhetoric for basically kind of proto-fascist ideal of cleansing. Now, there's nothing I hate more than the new misusage of the idea of what fascism is in the States. America's gone totally crazy, accusing half the country accuses an American president, who's, you know, of course, very unpleasant fellow, of being a Hitler or Mussolini when he's basically just a Berlusconi, you know? It's utterly amazing how that word has been devalued in the States. We should stop using that word in the West when it means nothing about popular conservative nationalists who are titular conservative nationalists. But here you really do have a guy who is fighting for a kind of purifying idea of the state's values and power, trying to quote unquote denazify a multicultural, multi-ethnic, cosmopolitan, civic, national state led by a bunch of Jews in the name of anti-Hitlerism. It's utterly, utterly remarkable.
Before we let you go, I'd just like to ask, you know, being in Ukraine and traversing the border and traveling throughout the country, was there one moment that stands out as something that was unique, that showed you something new that you didn't know about the people who you consider yourself one of the Ukrainian people?
Look, first thing I noticed is there's not a single road sign anywhere in Ukraine. every single road sign except to where the next restaurant is. Literally, the only ones which are up are hotel 5 miles or restaurant 4 miles or half a mile. There is not a single road marker anywhere in the country. Every single road marker, that means which cities in which direction, which towns in which direction, how many miles to this, how many miles to that, how many kilometers to the airport. Every single one has been taken down by the state. Nothing stands. There's no way to know if you're an occupying army taxi driver or driving a tank or a tractor, which direction anything is in. And they don't have cell phones because all their cell phones are confiscated. So I have no idea how they're figuring out where they are, if these old maps, when they have no cell phones or no geolocation, because the Russian army cannot have them listening to the news, which is horrific for them. So that's one thing. Second thing, there are roadblocks everywhere, and it's completely orderly. Ukrainians are anarchic at best, but the way that they've set up roadblocks, the way they've stood up in a cohesive way to fight, it's utterly, to me, unprecedented from what I've seen of their incapacity to organize certain things. They just don't have like that German thing or that Anglo-American thing or that Russian thing where they're good at logistical stuff. But they stood up in this moment and did that. That's one thing. Real cohesion. I knew that about the Ukrainians. I guess that's a good answer, right?
That's a good answer. Yeah. Well, we hope you stay safe. And Vladislav, and we thank you for taking the time out to speak to us. And we'll stay in touch. We'll keep an eye out for your tweets and your reports. Thank you.
Keep up the good work. I'm writing. In fact, I'm doing something on Zelensky, the Jew, and what it means that he's a Jew and a hero for this country. What it means historically, I'm going to be doing that for Tablet either today or tomorrow. Tablet's a great magazine. I write for them. Mm-hmm. I have a book coming out on the Ukrainian-Jewish relationship from Ibadim Press and Columbia. In fact, I will have to rewrite the entire book because of the events of the last week. And I have already a book which is very heavy on these issues from Academica Press called From Odessa with Love. If you're interested in my reportage, that's 45 of my pieces and essays about Ukraine, about a third of them from Tablet Magazine, a lot of them having to do with Jewish culture. I am really grateful that you had me on.
And we will definitely share a link to your books on the page of this podcast. So thank you, Vladislav, and stay safe.
Thank you.
Slava Ukraine, glory to Ukraine. We will win.
Zvika Klein, the Jerusalem Post's Jewish world analyst, flew out on Tuesday morning to Warsaw, Poland. And he's been spending the last couple of days traversing Poland, basically going from Warsaw to the border and back and forth, meeting with Jewish refugees, reporting from the border, seeing firsthand what's happening with the refugee crisis, not just Jewish, obviously, but just Ukrainian in general, but meeting with a lot of the Jewish organizations. So, Tzvika, tell us, what's happening there? What's the mood like? And what are Jewish or Israeli organizations actually doing?
So hi, Yaakov and Lahav from the freezing cold Poland. So first of all, it's really cold, and that actually affects the situation because I was at the border yesterday, the Ukrainian Polish border. It's next to a town called Madika, and I would say more than 250,000. People passed through, at least when I was there, and people finally are able to go through this border, and they're just freezing cold because, some people were in buses or in cars, but even so, driving in a car for 3 days on very slow pace with kids or with elderly people, and even just people our age, I don't know, I wouldn't want to be in a car for 3 days and just be stuck there. People were walking for days. And, it was during the day, it could be zero degrees Celsius, and then at night minus, and some areas actually have snow. And people are arriving to the other side of the border, and they're shaking. Physically, emotionally, psychologically also. So it's very, very difficult. And it's really, as you said, there are Jews, right? And there are just, you know, anyone else in Ukraine, whether they are Ukrainian citizens, many are like foreign students, foreign workers that were there. So it's easier for them to get out. And one thing which is really important to understand is if you're a man from the age of 18 to 60, you can't just leave Ukraine unless you have three children or are exempt for some very extreme sort of situation. So,
because all the men have to serve in the army right now, all expected to fight against Russia. Right.
Exactly. And, you know, and they all are supposed to be doing this, but most of them are not actually qualified to be combat fighters. Many of them are just, you know, using guns for the first time. And then you have the Jewish aspect, which is fascinating. And I wrote a piece in the Jerusalem Post where pretty much, I think, you know, it's actually a privilege to be a Jew today in Europe, because I don't know, 80 years ago during the Holocaust, we were in a very different situation. And now if you're a Jew, there are so many people that are potentially looking after you and trying to help you get out of Ukraine, help you start a new life, or even just maintain your life or move to Israel. The amount of money and the amount of resources put into this type of saving Jews' lives is a very positive thing.
Thank God. That's why we have Israel, right? I mean,
100%.
And have you been seeing the diplomats on the borders? I mean, the foreign ministry puts out messages all the time, and the ambassadors are tweeting pictures that they have people 24/7 at border crossings in multiple countries helping people get through. So what have you been seeing?
Here's the thing, right? I didn't. I know there were Israeli foreign ministry people on the other side of the border I was in. So they were on the Ukrainian side and they were passing. I didn't meet them. But I assume, just like, you know, you're a diplomatic correspondent, so like you're on that beat. And like what you're imagining, I was imagining is that, like, in every one of these borders, Israel's got like this like little, I don't know, hut or tent or even just like a table. And they're like operating from there. And I assumed the same thing in my beat with the Jewish organizations. That wasn't the situation that I saw. Again, I'm not saying that they're not, you know, working and doing what they should be doing. But I don't think that there, I mean, I may be wrong on this. I feel like there's not enough personnel and enough people working for these, whether government ministries or Jewish organizations, there's just
For the foreign ministry, there's never going to be enough people. They're always going to be, I think they were supposed to be on strike or something like that this week also. So, you know, the fact that they're able to do something is important. Tzvika, a couple of questions. One is, you know, as you mentioned, all of the Jewish organizations and Lav mentioned the foreign ministry, and obviously Israel is doing a lot. And I think it's quite clear that if you are Jewish, Israel is going to be there and is going to do everything it can to help to get you out. But I did hear Natan Sharansky, the former prisoner of Zion, famous Israeli hero, Jewish hero, minister, head of Jewish agency.
Right, who was actually born in Donetsk.
Okay, he was born in Ukraine, who said, you know, we also got to be a little careful about dual loyalty accusations that might come out and things along those lines. Do you get that sense at all? Is that something that comes up? Are people talking about it?
I understand what Sharansky is saying. And I also kind of like, in a way, felt like, are we boasting too much about this? I haven't heard it, though. I could tell you that.
By the way, just on that note, I was speaking with someone in a big Jewish organization in the U.S. the other day. Yeah. And they said, yeah, we've given a lot of money to Jewish refugees, but we also realized the other day we should also probably give some money to just general refugees as well. So they've done that now, too.
Well, yeah. So at the end of the day, like, you're not, even if, you know, you state in your press release that you're just taking care of Jewish refugees, you know, there's intermarriage, there are neighbors, there are, you know, humanitarian situations. So it's not like they're just doing, you know, work with the Jew, with, you know, the Jewish community of Ukraine. And by the way, also, everyone says a different number about how many Jews there are in Ukraine, right? It's, you know, the organizations will say 200 or 300,000. If you ask, you know, Sergio de la Pergola, the professor, the demographer, he'll tell you 50,000. So
no, but I think it's 50,000 halachic, and then it's like the larger number is the
he's saying that's law of return, I think, and I don't know. It's very complicated. But
I also think we're unique in that we're always counting how many people we have. You know, I don't know. Like, the Scottish people are constantly counting. You know, how many Scots do we have in this country? Like, but us Jews, we're obsessed with counting. Yeah. No. Is it 50,000? Are they just
halachic?
Are they law of return?
famous Dag Nachash song about that. But I just want to say that there are Jewish Israeli organizations on the border. There's an organization, a small organization called Rescuing Without
Borders.
Yeah. Nothing to do with Hatzalah, if I'm correct. And they had an Arab doctor, a female Israeli Jewish nurse, and paramedics from Israel. They built this hut with an Israeli flag with Hebrew all over it, and they're just, you know, the Red Cross had to move a few kilometers away, and they're just like taking care of everybody, and it's amazing.
Yeah, and by the way, the foreign ministry is helping other people as well. I mean, obviously the priority is Israelis, but like there are like hundreds, or there were hundreds of Israeli Arab students studying in Ukraine, and a bunch of them asked, can I bring my friends on the bus to get out of Ukraine? And in the end, it turned out Israel was helping people evacuate from countries, people who are citizens of Lebanon and Syria, you know, countries that are officially enemy states, as well as the countries that we have peace with, like Egypt and Morocco.
Yeah. And there was like, so there was this hut, and then you have them taking care of people. And there was a woman who had a heart attack. And like, they're not asking people, the basis that they work on is we're giving, you know, service to anyone. And there's this priest who comes and is like, he decides he's part of this organization now, a local Polish priest. And he's just like telling the doctor, tell me what to do. I'm your soldier. I'm doing whatever you need to, whatever is needed. And there was like, there were many, obviously, as we know, there are many journalists from all over the world. And then there's this German journalist who's like, oh, Israel, is this the government of Israel? I was like, no, it's an organization. He's like, I was based in Israel and in Gaza, and I'm such a huge fan, and this is amazing, and you guys are doing such amazing work. And many other people were like, wow, you know. There weren't other, you know, organizations from just random countries building a hut with medical personnel and giving, and, you know, and helping people out. So I think
I think, as Lahav said, that's what the state of Israel is for, and Israel excels at that. You know, we've seen countless times after natural disasters or emergencies around the world that Israel knows how to mobilize, and Israel knows how to get there and take care of people, whether it's their own people or other people. And it's really, it's moving, and it's incredible to see these images that Tzvika, you've been taking and filming from the border, but also Lav has been writing about from what the foreign ministry has been doing. Tzvika, tell us a story, something that caught your eye, a moving moment at the border, at one of the refugee camp hotels, something, you know, personalize it for us.
So, I mean, there's this family I wrote about, and you can read it on the Jerusalem Post website. It's the Forrest family. They're from Kiev, Ukraine. They're not a poor family. You know, he's a swimming instructor, I think, for, you know, Olympics. She owns this a chain of schools, private schools that teach English, and she's an educator. A beautiful family. And I see them, you know, I'm sitting with the Jewish Agency emissary, their shaliach, who's running like the operation. And I said, can I speak to one of the families? He's like, oh, you know, that family over there, they're sitting at the end of the bar. Two of the parents are drinking beer, and, you know, they're all blonde, blue eyes, beautiful family, and their kids are sitting there on their cell phones. And I was like, wait, they're refugees? Like, that's it? And then it kind of struck me. And I spoke to them, and they said, you know, we actually packed bags, but when we got to the embassy or the, I don't know, Lahav will tell me exactly what the, there was in Lvov, basically, it was like a temporary embassy, Israeli embassy, whatever situation. There was, you know, there were shootings or shellings over the city. So they just ran, they left their car, they ran to the bus, and they had, you know, the clothes that they were wearing, their documents, their passports, their cell phone, and that's about it. And it's just, it's crazy because this is like a normal Jewish family.
And now they're moving to Israel.
They're making Aliyah today. His mother lives in Be'er Sheva. They want to live in Netanya. You know, I'm hoping, and she's like, I'm just not looking back. I'm not looking back. I'm hoping that, you know, our life will be in Israel. It'll be a better life. And, you know, and she left her parents there. She left her brother there. You know, it's a very tough situation. And the only reason he was allowed out because he was married previously and had another child. So he's a father to three. And if you're a father to three, you're allowed to leave. So they said all their neighbors and friends who were eligible to make Aliyah just can't leave.
So one last question before I think we have to go. I wanted to ask you about the orphanages. There are all these Jewish orphanages in Ukraine. Last night or the night before this interview, we got the news that 100 children were able to get into Romania, even though a lot of them didn't have passports or anything. What are you hearing about these hundreds of Jewish children?
Right. So, I mean, there are amazing people in Ukraine that run these orphanages, Jewish orphanages. They're not all orphans.
Yeah.
I was just saying, in the 90s, there were situations like this. There were thousands of Jewish orphans across the former Soviet Union. This is a story that one day I will actually have time to sit down and write a huge story. It was never told, but there were thousands of Jewish orphans around the USSR, and the Israeli government actually, you know, saved them and brought them to Israel. And it's complicated because it can be considered as if you are kidnapping kids and moving into different countries. So it's very problematic. And I hope that they'll find some sort of a solution.
Well, Tzvika, thanks for, you know, being with us. I guess we'll have to talk later because think about what we're going to be writing today.
But I was like, maybe this is instead of our conversation, but no, we have a few things to talk about. Okay.
We still have a few things to talk about, but Tzvika, thanks a lot. You know, keep up the good work in Poland.
Thank you guys.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. We're here every week. If you enjoyed it, please send the link to your friends, to your family. We are on all the major podcasting platforms, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and others. We will be back next week.